You're listening to KYRS 88.1 and 92.3 FM. Hi, everybody. It's Federica on the show. So did you hear? Welcome back and thank you for joining me. I am doing a pre-recorded show today. I've got some travel plans coming up, so that's kind of what works best for us. But hopefully everything sounds good through the speakers. I'm using a different setup today, so hopefully that's all smooth. But today, I'm continuing a conversation that I started last week. If you're listening to this live on the air in Friday, November 21st, 2025. If not, it will be, you know, because this will probably be aired again. So, anyways, this is part two of a conversation which I started with my guest who is here with me today. Joining us is Tara Lee. She is a former nurse who specializes in adolescent psychiatry. She's also experienced the world of psychiatry as a patient. And we are discussing the world, the crazy world of institutions, and specifically we're talking about institutions that are supposed to serve as safety nets for us in society, but oftentimes those safety nets fail and end up being more dysfunctional than they are functional. This is a topic that I like to circle back to on my show every once in a while. For those of you who keep up with the show, you know that I kind of go all over the place. This is a contemporary culture and society talk show, so I talk about all manner of things. Some topics are a little bit more lighthearted and creative, and I also like to dedicate time to discussing things that are issues in our society. And if you know, if there's anything I can do as the small human being I am, is at least to help spread conversations about important issues. So we live in an era in which we are surrounded by institutions that, well, fail us. When I'm talking about with institutions, I mean the systems that societies create to basically create a safety net for ourselves when things go wrong in our personal lives, and also to just keep things running smoothly. So they are the constructs, the buttresses that are supposed to help kind of keep society healthy, functional, and provide a safety net to people and individuals as they experience misfortune in life. These are going to be your hospitals. It's going to be your medical industry in general, your psychologist, psychiatry, anything relating to mental health, all health institutions. It's your academic institutions. It's the government, etc. It's, you know, the man, if you would say, the
legal system and law enforcement.
Legal system and law enforcement, exactly. You know, it's all different variations of what one might call the man, right? So institutions that are in place to supposedly serve society and are supposed to help people. This has always been the case, but it seems especially so nowadays that our institutions are really just falling apart right and left as the world changes. And it has a very real, painful impact on people. It really is a very costly issue, because when we can't trust our institutions to keep us safe and to, you know, do the things that they're supposed to do, what do we turn to? Mm-hmm. It's a real problem that is a very real and lived experience for many of us. Tara has an especially extensive story of running into problems and basically being failed by institutions that are supposed to be helpful but end up being more dysfunctional than they are functional. So we're continuing that conversation today. Part one, by the way, of this conversation should be on my show page at So Did You Hear on the KYRS website. Easy way to find that. Go to Google, throw in So Did You Hear KYRS, and it'll show up on the playlist. I am updating that. I update that playlist about once monthly, so it should be up there soon, and if it's not yet. But if you're listening to this later in 2025 or a time after 2025, it should be there. Okay, so let's get into it, Tara. Thank you for joining me again today and for sharing your story. Yeah, absolutely. We had a really good conversation last week about this topic, and we when you reached out to me and to us, you shared a really passionate story about your experiences ending in family court. Mm-hmm. And that is, so the court system and the law enforcement justice system in general, I mean, is there any shortage of stories about how the justice system fails? I mean, yeah. It seems to be like that's more common than, there's more like bad stories about the criminal justice and the justice system in general than there are good ones. Mm-hmm. But you've had a very extensive experience with that.
Yeah.
You've lived that firsthand, particularly with family court. And so I want to give you kind of the lead here today to talk about your experience. But before we do, when we started the conversation last week, we went into more of like the whole backstory of how it is that you ended up in family court to begin with. Mm-hmm. And that led to a conversation which ended up being much deeper and broader about, you know, what has to happen to people for them to end up in a family court in the first place. And so that led to a much deeper conversation on things like trauma and the medical and mental health fields, and how folks who are in a kind of down and out in a bad place and were in a very vulnerable position who have experienced trauma, first of all, you know, the first institutions that they usually run into problems with is the medical field. Mm-hmm. And the mental health field. And that's kind of where it starts before you even get to the family court situation in a lot of cases. So, if you're interested in hearing more about the psychology side of the conversation in the mental health field, I would encourage you to check out the first episode of this series. But we talked a lot about trauma and the way that the medical health field and the way that the mental health field, particularly in the way it operates with the medical model for diagnosis, just create almost just kind of butchers the reality of what's actually going on with folks. And these things are changing. There's a lot of new research and kind of new methodology coming out that I think better encaptures how to respond to folks experiencing trauma. And it's changing, but it's still full of problems.
Yeah. So. I think there is some good research. We have to be careful about the research because it is heavily, heavily funded by pharmaceuticals. Some diagnoses are created specifically so that the pharmaceutical company can sell drugs, like most
particularly
of
in the United States. I think we should preface
ADHD
in the United States.
In particular, like ADHD is, is exploding. And it's not really that there's more incidents. It's just that people, instead of dealing with the causes of attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, they just medicate it. And the medication is speed. And, you know, it's essentially meth. You know,
it's diet meth. That's what I've got. Yeah, Adderall, yeah. Really. It's one molecule.
It's coffee, it's crack, it's cocaine, it's any of the stimulants, right?
It's like one polymethylene group, one like very small chemical structure away from being literal methamphetamine.
Yeah, I think it's methylphenidate. I'm not sure the exact, but that's Adderall, and it's handed out like candy.
Dextroamphetamine, that's the one
that I
was also prescribed.
Right. So, yeah, amphetamine. So, again, you know, we don't want to go too far down that road, but we have to, you know, you mentioned the studies, and you have to be really careful about how you interpret the studies, because there's so much conflict of interest
just to clarify that a little bit, I think maybe a better word for it or a better way to put it is that there are a lot of new ideas and people challenging the system and creating new avenues to understand
trauma,
but also all kinds of mental health conditions and things that we label as disorders. There are actually quite a few professionals in the field, some of which I've had, you know, I was fortunate enough to discover in my own journey when I, you know, was dealing really heavily with issues related to trauma, that offer a different avenue and a different path and challenge the diagnosis model that we have. Yeah. So there are things changing, but it really
takes a lot of pushback on that, right? The mainstream, as I read in an article recently, the mental health industrial complex. So now that's been put into that. And the psychiatry and the mental health industrial complex kind of push back a lot on some of these more, they're not alternative views. They're just perspectives that are, I believe, more humane and more compassionate than the ones that we've, you know, traditionally been used. And it's hard to, it's still very much an old boys club in psychiatry, especially. And the training has not kept up with the research at all.
Right.
But we were going to try and segue from that into the family court system. And kind of what we were talking about before we got on was that the problem with the family court system, and this is, you know, this is relatively new information for me, which is kind of embarrassing because why didn't I know this before? But it wasn't until I started to hang out at the family court because I was there defending myself from my own therapist, believe it or not, that I realized how, not just how dysfunctional it is, but how truly abusive it is. And it's creating this even bigger divide between the people of privilege and the people who are really struggling. I mean, not just kind of struggling, but really, really struggling. And it creates this cycle of abuse that these people get to know the family court system better than the actual attorneys do because they've been through it so many times. So I was there for the first time about a month ago, maybe a little bit longer. And because of my first experience being so traumatic for me, I kept going back to just observe and talk to other victims of the system. And I actually got much better advice from other both accusers and respondents than I did from the legal professionals.
Hmm.
And that terrified me because it made me realize that it's not unless you're in that, swimming in that pond, that you understand what it's like to be in that horrific pond. So I did have my hearing last week and I lost. So I was found guilty. I mean, it's not guilty because it's family court, so it's not criminal at all. It's which is kind of crazy. But I was found guilty of threatening my therapist with a weapon. And the weapon was text messages. So it was a pretty traumatizing experience for me. I was fairly sure that I was going to be found not, you know, not culpable or whatever. I don't know what the terminology they use. Essentially, she has a protection order against me for the rest of my life. Like, I can't, you know, which I don't even know where she lives. It's kind of crazy. It's just very abusive because, A, I don't have weapons, and she knows that. And B, a text message is not a weapon. Words are not weapons. They can feel like weapons sometimes, but they're not, you know, they can't cause physical harm. And, you know, the reality is if I had in fact threatened her with a weapon, she would have called 911, the police would have been called, I would have been arrested, my weapon would have been taken away, end of story. But instead, she just filed a protection order against me saying that I had threatened her with a text message, which is not true. So it was very surreal because I came in, you have about an hour, but they only give you, I think it's 10 minutes to speak. So she got to speak first, and she could split her 10 minutes. So she got first and last, and I got to speak in the middle. She spoke a little bit, then I spoke my piece, and then she spoke a little bit more.
And you don't have like a rebuttal to the rebuttal.
But he kind of let me do that. But it was such an odd experience. And she was there all by herself, which I found interesting that she, you know, didn't have an attorney. But I was there. I'd lost my attorney, as I think I mentioned to you, because of other abuses that had happened in the system. An attorney I'd paid $5,000 to couldn't represent me on this case. And this is a therapist I'd worked with for 5 months who I'd paid over $4,000 to. Like, I just feel like I'm bleeding money to these people that I'm trying to get to help me with my mental health only to be abused by them. But I did bring a friend with me In person. And then I had my daughter and another friend were able to Zoom in. So it was really comforting to me to have witnesses, because I don't think anyone would have believed what happened if I didn't have someone saying, yeah, this was crazy. Because I truly thought that the judge was going to find in my favor. And he, at the very end, he listened to me a lot. He said, you know, he said all the right stuff. Like, I have a lot of empathy for you. I see you've been through a lot of trauma. I mean, when you have to tell someone that you have empathy for them, it's unlikely that you actually do, because you shouldn't have to say it. But he was not, I mean, he was a nice guy, but he's a judge. And he actually said, the system is broken, but the law is the law.
Oh, so he's that this was this or this is an actual like quote that
you yes, he said so he said the system is broken, but the law is the law.
Wow.
And it's crazy because I had even brought two, you know, examples of two laws that she had broken, which are she lied to law enforcement because she said I threatened her with a weapon and I did not. I don't have weapons, right? So she lied to the court, to law enforcement, which is a crime. And she released privileged information about me in the paperwork that she filed, like my history of suicidality, my history of trauma, my history of
weaponizing your trauma. Yeah,
exactly.
You.
And she,
in that case,
that's privileged information, and she put it in a public document. I don't have secrets, so I don't, you know, I tell lots of people that I have struggled with suicidality off and on for the past, since 2020, and I had an attempt, and I don't hide that because it does no good to pretend that we aren't struggling as much as we're struggling. But my suicidality is the result of institutional betrayal. As we were talking, right? It's not my family has betrayed me. My ex-husbands have betrayed me. My friends have betrayed me. But the suicidality was a result of my psychiatrist, my attorney, my therapist, the system, the betrayal in the system.
Well, that speaks volumes in and of itself.
Mm-hmm.
When we're talking about, especially if you're talking about suicidality, from my understanding, it seems that, when folks end up in that sort of situation, I mean, there can be a variety of causes, but, if even the last line of defense and protection fails, I mean, it's not surprising that folks end up in that kind of that space, which is an absolute travesty.
Right.
So I want to really lean in and kind of get deeper with your personality, the story that you've just shared with us. But, I want to really kind of spend some time on this and mull over the idea of like the institution and the words that the judge said. Now that somebody in that position would even openly admit to the fact that it sounds like basically they're saying, hey, look, I don't agree with it, but I have to I have to play by the rules, even if the rules are broken. I mean, what do you do with that?
You don't. And the travesty is, you know, when I was suicidal in 2020, I did what I thought I was supposed to do. I called suicide helplines. I called, I tried to call friends. Some were open to talking to me. Lots were not. People are very, very terrified of talking to someone who's suicidal. It's far more common than we believe. Like, once you start talking to people earnestly, you realize, whoa, a lot more people have thought about this than I ever imagined.
Yeah.
And the sad thing is most people don't want to admit it because we get stigmatized. And that's exactly what happened to me. So I get labeled as crazy for admitting that I'm hopeless and helpless and lost and lonely and depressed.
Why do you think, I don't mean to interrupt, but why do you think that is? Is it that people fear those things within themselves, so hearing somebody else's story makes them feel vulnerable? Do you think it's like it's almost like a weird convoluted self-protection
thing?
It's
so crazy because one of the women who is most sort of abusive towards me, her mother killed herself when she was 19. When this young woman was 19 years old, she's my age now, Her mother killed herself. Similar story to Sylvia Plath, if you know that story at all. I mean, I adore Sylvia Plath. She's an awesome poet, but she killed herself at 32 with, she's the author of The Bell Jar, if you know that story. This is a really, actually, this could be a whole episode. So The Bell Jar is a story that Sylvia Plath, it's memoirish, but she wrote it as a novel, right? So it's third person, made up names, but it is autobiographical, and it's about her experience at McLean Hospital, which is the same hospital that I admitted myself to in 2024, and I had worked there. So this hospital, it's a beautiful old buildings on this big grounds. The grounds were designed by the Olmsted brothers, who were the same Olmsted brothers that did the parks in Spokane. Like, it's crazy connection. And it's beautiful old buildings, and it's very famous because, do you know the movie Girl Interrupted?
I know of it.
So that's based on a true story of a girl, Kaysen, I'm blanking on her first name, who had also experience. They fictionalized it, but it's based on her actual story and her inpatient stay at McLean Hospital. The Bell Jar is based on McLean Hospital. James Taylor was a patient there. John Nash, who was a brilliant mind, that he's also, so there's, McLean Hospital has this storied history of, you know, very famous, I mean, I almost said inmates, patients, but you feel like an inmate when you're there. But what's so interesting about it is I admitted myself there because I really believed that they were going to be able to help me. But they didn't at all. In fact, they just stigmatized me more. And once I came out, then I got, 4 days later, I got involuntarily committed by my family to an even worse place. And it was just like, as soon as I was deeply depressed, instead of, and this is what our society does, right? Mm-hmm. If you don't have a decent enough support system, family, friends, and you claim that you're suicidal, they immediately want to lock you away in a facility for your protection. That's what they say, you know, so that you don't hurt yourself. But it feels horrible to be locked away from society. And it's far more common, and I found this out after the fact, suicide is far more common after one admission. Because nobody wants to admit they're suicidal again because they don't want to go back to the prison. And so instead of admitting to suicidality, and this is 100% what happened to me, I had a second admission that was horrific, and I got out of that second one. I wandered the world, literally, like I went from where I was in Massachusetts to Western Massachusetts, back to Eastern Massachusetts. I flew to Norway. I flew to Amsterdam, and I stayed in Amsterdam for a couple of days, just wandering the streets, desperately wanting to kill myself. Ended up back in Washington, D.C. instead of in Boston. It's a crazy story. But that's where I impulsively, in the middle of the night, downed a bottle of pills. Not planned at all. I just was so desperately lonely and sad. And everywhere I'd reached out to help, professionals, family, friends, nobody knew how to deal with my level of grief and trauma. And, you know, this was almost a year to the day after my mom had died in a pretty, you know, pretty traumatic situation. So yeah, it was August 21st, 2024. And I celebrated my 60th birthday in Georgetown University Medical Center. And I can say that in Washington, D.C. But the reason I wanted to share that story is to humanize people who are struggling with suicidality, because we do not want to admit that we are so low, because we will be locked up. We'll be medicated, pathologized, institutionalized. Mm. And when you go into I talk to people, you think of the prison pipeline. The prison pipeline is similar to the psychiatric pipeline, right?
It seems to me like there's a class difference there, because people with more privilege end up in psych wards.
Exactly.
People who are very underprivileged and poor end up in prison.
100%.
People of color particularly.
So it's so true. Like the second hospital. I can't even call it a hospital. It was a behavioral health center. It was like, it was worse than a prison. I mean, transponder on my ankle, you know, limited visiting hours. I couldn't touch my child when she came to visit me. I mean, it was like a prison. And those, like, the poor people end up in facilities like that. Wealthy people end up in facilities like McLean, which is, you know, and you can even pay for luxury at McLean. Oh my gosh, don't get me started on that. That's a topic. Oh, Britney Spears and Paris Hilton. We should talk about that.
Okay.
next, yeah, let's talk about informed consent. And Britney Spears and Paris Hilton have huge stories. Like, I have so much compassion for those two women because they were locked away in palaces that were prisons. You know what I mean? Like, lots of money, lots of money spent on locking them away. But,
there's a lot of profoundly
and the prison, as you're saying, like,
story there.
Prison. I met a man who had been both in prison and at a psych facility. He said he'd prefer the prison because he knew what his sentence was, and all he had to do was serve a sentence, and he got out. When you're in a psych facility, you have to take the medications they tell you to take, you have to go to the programs they tell you to go to, and you have to prove to them that you're going to follow that safety. They call it a safety plan. Like, you have to sign a safety plan for them to discharge you. And part of the safety plan is, like, promising that you're not going to kill yourself. And it's like,
okay, great. Yes. Well, if you're dead, you can't leave. Right. So what?
So, wow. You know, so I have this insider's view, and this is from 2024, right? So I'm thinking, okay, somebody's going to want to hear this story. Like, this is crazy. It's like, if I had chosen to be a mole in the psychiatric system, I couldn't have done a better job of, you know, pretending that I was crazy to get admitted, right? Involuntarily committed by my family twice. And the second time was what brought me back to Spokane against my will. It's not what I wanted, but I was given no choice. A facility in the Spokane Valley, I won't name, but it cost $4,000 a week. My family paid $4,000 for 1 week. They thought I was going to stay there from 6 weeks to 90 days. And my ex-husband was going to pay for that. And I'm like, when I found out, you know, I'm like, why would you lock me up for $4,000 a week? Like, why don't you just help me live on the outside? You know, like, why would you invest that much money in having me locked up? It makes no sense. And my daughter was forced into the middle of this mess because she was 21 at the time. So she was the one that was making the actual decisions, which I found abusive to my own child. Right? Mm-hmm. She should never have been put in a position of making major decisions for her own mother. You know, and the system is telling my 21-year-old daughter, this is what's best for your mom. She needs professional help.
Okay, so there's a lot to unpack
brutal.
There.
So brutal.
Yeah, there's certainly a lot to unpack here. And, you know, what I'm hearing that I keep coming back to, your story, I mean, I think, as you said, first of all, when we're mentioning about, like, suicidality, I'll put a content disclaimer about this at the beginning of the show, but I think one of the reasons that, I mean, I, as somebody who has experienced ideations for a brief period, it's, I mean, it's different for everybody, but I was fortunate to have a very good therapist that I love her so much.
Yeah,
she really was very helpful.
There are some awesome, awesome therapists, coaches, psychiatrists. I mean, there are really good people in the field.
It almost seems like a lottery. It's, like, I got lucky finding a really good therapist. Yeah. And one of the first, what to me made her stand out as a good therapist is she was very aware of everything that you've just said here.
Yeah.
All the stigmatization, the dysfunction of the system, and the system not knowing what to do with people and tossing them around. These are things that she was very aware of and spoke openly about. And she did speak openly about stigma and how, you know, maybe many, many more people experience things like suicidal ideation than we are aware of because I think, well, it's scary. It's scary to talk about it, and people are scared to...
to admit to it. They're scared to admit to it.
Well, I think...
No, I mean, scared to... The individual's scared to admit, but the people receiving the information, like, I know with my mom, she couldn't handle it. She couldn't handle me talking about that. And, you know, I tried to protect her from my own fears, but it's hard when you have, I mean, my mom was a social worker, so she should have known better. But like, I didn't know. My mom was very judgmental about people who killed themselves. She found it that it was very selfish. You know, she would talk about, I remember the very first like suicide of somebody that I knew was my mom's coworker's husband. And my mother was so angry at this man. And, you know, I'm a kid at the time, so I don't, like, I'm like, oh, what a horrible thing to do to his kids. Like, that's what my mom said. But, like, when I started experiencing it myself, I thought, wait a minute. Like, why are we blaming people for their own misery? You know, it's not like, nobody asks for that. Like, nobody asks to be hopeless and helpless and feeling worthless, you know?
I think there's, I think, and this is actually something I talked about with, like, you know, with my therapist in that time. People, it's very hard to explain the kind of state of being a person has to be in to be in that place where it feels like nothing, you know, it's almost like you're not even a human anymore.
Yeah.
You have to, it's very hard for people to wrap their heads around it. Imagine, and the only people who really maybe understand are people who have been in a space like that. I mean, it happened for me. Thankfully this only happened for a brief period. It only lasted a couple of months and I was able to get better and I was never active, but I was thinking, and it was literally because I was so sick that I thought, like, I literally can't live. If I'm stuck sick like this, I can't live life.
Yeah.
And that there's no room for any other, well, I don't know. Everybody handles it in a different way. And I just want to say, like, this is not to say, I don't want people hearing this to be more discouraged from seeking help. That is not what this is.
Because it's help for sure, but there is, just be careful where you look.
Well, and yeah, I guess that's where it does look different for people. I was very fortunate in that I have a very supportive family.
Yeah.
I was lucky to have a good support system with, like the health and psychology field. Like, I had a really good therapist. And I don't know, I guess maybe I had this internal fortitude that I never thought I'd had or would have to use today. I literally, like, screamed at myself every day, like, I have to be okay.
Yeah.
And that's my story. That's kind of, everybody's is different. But the thing that I kind of want to bring it back to is that the idea of not talking about it makes it, like, not talking about these things makes it worse.
Worse.
And I think
100%.
What helped for me was to be able to be encouraged to speak about it. And I mean, it's uncomfortable for anyone listening.
So I was,
I think some people, people, people just don't know how to respond unless they've been there. I didn't understand it until I had an episode where it happened, where I, you know, was so sick that I had a period of suicidal ideation. Then it was like, that version of me was not me. It was like, your brain is literally not functioning properly.
It is. It's a form of psychosis. It's a form of psychosis where you're not you. Reality is warped.
It's like, I would describe it as like, it's like being stuck in a bad trip.
Yep.
If anybody who's done psychedelics, it was like, it's like being stuck in a bad trip where nothing feels real.
Mm-hmm.
People, like, that is how altered your brain activity is. And somebody who has a altered brain like that isn't thinking like everybody else. They're not, you know, it's not like people are making the active conscious choice to abandon their family members, etc. Like, it is a product of sickness.
It's impulsive. It's always impulsive. I mean, sometimes, yes, it's planned out, but it's like, it's, people try really hard not to attempt. I mean, and I get blamed for speaking for other people. So I'm like you. This is my story. It's just that a lot of people I have talked to are like, when they hear my story, they completely understand. They said, yeah, that is exactly what it was like for me. And the main thing I think I want to make sure we get through two things. Is one, it's far more common than we think, which is tragic, but it also means you're not alone. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like you were saying, the stigmatization of speaking about it just makes it worse.
Like it does with anything else.
With anything else, like eating disorders. I was an eating disorder expert when I was a pediatric nurse. And, you know, that's a form of escaping the pain, right? So we were talking about trauma responses, right? Mm-hmm. So suicidality is like the extreme of a flight response. You know, addiction, attention deficit, perfectionism, all these things are flight trauma responses, distraction, every single addiction. And at the end of that extreme, escaping the pain, because it's all flight is to escape the pain, is suicide.
Yeah.
And so, no, like, few people, I mean, lots of people with suicidal ideation, but few of them think they're actually going to go through with it. But as you said, it's you end up in this dissociated state of psychosis where you're not thinking straight and all you want is to stop the pain. And speaking of psychedelics and substances, you know, that's why there's so many accidental overdoses that they're not sure if it's suicide or accidental, because there's such a tie between addiction and suicide, mm-hmm. right? And the legal medications they give us create that dissociation. You know, the antipsychotics, the SSRIs, I don't like at all. Those are the antidepressants that they numb everything.
That's what and I heard so a lot you, of people
and
say.
Yes, and they have really extreme physical effects, and I'll say it on the radio. Anorgasmia is very common side effect, and it can be permanent. So yeah. It's,
and I think that's sorry to interrupt. Yeah. Was, like it's very and that's such a gamble too, because I have had I have been on SSRIs and I didn't have too many side effects besides the brain zaps. That was really annoying, but it wasn't anything like. Again, it's really varies on the person, and I did want to just note here again. I don't want to this to be a means for people to discourage taking medications, because like. Okay, so I did take those medications. Yeah. Not antipsychotics. I've been on SSRIs, but I did find that for the period I took it, it was helpful. This is never us saying
no.
Do or don't do something. I want to make that very clear. This is not
medical advice at all. This is
a overall conversation of our like your personal experiences space, and what is possible. And the point of this is just to give folks, it's encourage folks, I guess, or give folks. A motivation and inspiration to dig deeper and question.
Yeah.
And especially when it comes to the medical field and medications, et cetera, like this is not medical advice, but we can't, you know, it's always, I would say a good idea for me, what I found really helpful, I don't know about you, Tara, but take the kind of the reins in your own hand and do your own research.
Informed consent. There's this consent. Great book. And Rob Wypond wrote a book, and I've met him in person and seen him present, and he's awesome, a Canadian journalist. It's called Informed Consent. No, Your consent is not required. Your consent is not required. Sorry, I'm going to have to remember the title. Rob Wypond. Anyway, but Rob Wypond. Wypond. Your consent is not required. That's the title of it, and then the subtitle is about guardianships and, you know, involuntary commitments.
Ahead. I think so. Rob Wypond is a writer of investigative journalism, social commentary, and creative nonfiction. He's a speaker and also a performance artist, and glancing here, there was a Facebook post that this writer made about a few weeks ago, what looks like a couple weeks ago. He says, hospitals seek immunity from lawsuits for abusive psychiatric holds. A U.S. Supreme Court case about ICE prisons has attracted submissions for mental health care providers. This is a post he made while sharing an article on PsychForce. That report. So this is just kind of a glimpse of the kind of work he does.
And he's the one when we talked about Britney Spears and Paris Hilton earlier, mm-hmm. he's the one, that's where I learned about these forced hospitalizations, because both those women were forced into hospitalizations against their will.
That seems to happen. That's a, you know, I don't want to interrupt too much here, just to kind of keep things a little bit on topic, but I really want to note that I think it's interesting and it's worth mentioning that we're talking specifically about a lot of women being institutionalized. Yeah. And I think this really ties into the history of patriarchal systems.
Patriarchal, yeah, and paternalism. It's just so
we live in a system where there is a very long history of systems silencing women by society labeling women as crazy to throw them away into institutions to silence them. It's a method of oppression that has very long historical roots in the United States, in the Western world, all over.
Yes.
I mean, and so that is definitely something worth noting. Because our institutions, and I'm going to kind of bring it
back to the institutions. Yeah,
institutions are created by society, and anything that, no matter how unbiased, no matter how squeaky clean and balanced we try to be, our human, any system created by humans is going to experience human biases. The human bias is always going to snake its way into all of our institutions, and especially with something like the medical field and the psychological, like the psychiatric institution, where diagnoses and just the way that, and I don't want to get into too many details about this because we talked about it in the last show quite a bit, but the way that psychiatrists create labels and label and diagnose quote unquote disorders, it is all, there's a lot of subjective interpretation, and whenever anything is subject to interpretation, it's subject to human bias, and that's where you see people with marginalized identities being disproportionately harmed by these institutions. So it's women, it's people of color,
poor,
it's
people, people, disabled who, people, it's
any kind of marginalized person. It's gonna have a bigger impact on them than it would other privileged groups. And that's, I think, where, you know, I think this is a really good place to kind of pivot and talk about the kind of, that you talked a little bit about this with the mental institution, the trauma to mental institution
pipeline
and then the trauma to prison pipeline or the mental trauma, mental institution, prison pipeline. It's a whole pipeline.
And then add the schools, because a lot of, like, colleges, there's an awesome, I don't want to go down this rabbit hole because I want to go back to something, but colleges, there's an APM story called Under Pressure, and it's about the college mental health care crisis. And it's very revealing about how, you know, now these are very privileged kids that you know, the mental health crisis at the college level, higher ed, and it's because they're one of the institutions that is training the doctors, the lawyers, the nurses, the, you know, all the people that are stigmatizing their fellow human beings are being trained by these institutions of higher education. So it's like, yeah, they have to learn this stuff somewhere, right?
Right.
And they're so heavily influenced by research dollars from the pharmaceutical industry, from the health insurance industry. Like, everybody's making money off of our suffering. And off of the suffering of women, people of color, and all the marginalized populations, like you talked about. And I wanted to go back just quickly to the historical context of women, because we talked about last week how hysteria was the original borderline personality disorder, right? They've just updated the name. But the term gaslight comes from a movie, and it's a fictional movie, but about a woman, I think it was in the 1940s, who is psychologically abused by her husband to such a degree that she thinks she's insane. And it's just extreme psychological abuse, coercive control. But then there's a real story called The Yellow Wallpaper that's very similar. It's written by the victim. She was able to escape her abuser and write this book called The Yellow Wallpaper. Highly recommend it. It's a very little book, but it's about her. The reason it's called The Yellow Wallpaper is because after her son was born, the husband had her locked in a room. The child was taken away, locked in a room with yellow wallpaper, where he, very wealthy, had around the clock nurses coming in to care for his poor wife who was crazy. And she was crazy because she'd just given birth and had her kid taken away. I mean, like the insanity of it. But that was, you know, that was also in the like 40s or 50s. Right. And now it's 2025. And like my own situation isn't so far from that, right?
That's what, like, I find really disturbing about this, because I think
gaslighting is, oh, I could talk about gaslighting.
I think, well, so I, but, yeah, we can talk about it a little bit just so we have about 15 minutes here.
Yeah.
But because it is a term that gets thrown a lot around and has become saturated
and it's misused in pop psychology all the time. It's misused all the time.
So, before I think if we can kind of just briefly do an overview of what gaslighting is and versus what it's not. I think I don't want to give any wrong information here.
No, I can do this really
if you
fast.
Go ahead and
the psychological term for it. There is a psychological term for it. Obviously, it's called projective identification. So projection is projecting your own identity, shame, fears, anxieties onto, they call them targets, which is the victim, right? So an individual who is insecure, weak egoed, will project that weakness onto their target or their victim.
It's like,
and it's, yeah. So it's projective identification, projecting your own identity onto another person. So it's like saying to someone,
but it's things you don't like about yourself
all the time.
That's not, it's never something good. It's like people who project their own faults and the things they hate about themselves on other people. It's like every accusation is a confession.
So I'm sorry you feel that way is classic gaslighting, right? Like if you were sorry, you'd do something about it. So that's a lie. But like when anyone starts out with so the judge, right?
I have said that to people.
I know. It's hard, right? Well, we get, and this is an important thing to remember. We gaslight ourselves all the time. Oh my God, I'm such an idiot. Oh, I do this all the time. I'm such an idiot. Like, why am I such a sucker? Right? That's all self-gaslighting. It's self-talk, negative self-talk. And we, you know, occasionally invalidation is gaslighting, right? But it's chronic invalidation. We all invalidate each other sometimes. Like, you know, we don't know how to respond a lot of times. But when it becomes chronic, when it becomes the knee-jerk reaction, you know, and the judge said to me, I have empathy for you, but blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, the fact that you have to say you have empathy for me is a form of gaslighting, because it's sort of covering up the truth, which is if he did have empathy for me, he never would have put the restraining order into place, right? I actually had to sign a piece of paper confirming that I would relinquish all my weapons. And when I walked out with my friend, he says to me, does that mean you have to turn in your cell phone? I had to sign a piece of paper saying I would relinquish my weapons. And I'm like, I don't have weapons. Yeah, but you have to sign this paper. I mean, that's gaslighting. It's like, you have to do this stupid thing, even though it's made up. But gaslighting can be super simple, right? Just like, I said I was sorry. Or, you know, that's not what I meant. Or, you know, just, the basic goal behind gaslighting is to silence the other person, is to make it so they stop the conversation.
You placate, stop. Yeah.
Just stop talking. Anyway, before we went down the gaslighting route, I wanted to say one more thing about suicidality, because I don't want to leave people empty-handed, right?
Yeah, like, let's do that for sure.
This is more of a message for people who have loved ones who struggle. What I wanted to hear, and I've played this refrain so many times with other people who struggle with mental health issues, and they agree. What we want to hear when we admit to someone that we are feeling so hopeless and helpless and lost and lonely that we are thinking that we'd rather not be alive, the best thing to hear is, I'm here, I've got your back, I'm not leaving. And when I say that, I don't mean like I'm not leaving ever your side. It means I've got your back and I'm going to help you through this, right? Mm-hmm. That's what a person needs to hear, that someone is going to help them through this really, really dark period. Like you, my first suicidal ideation was in 2010 during a pretty deep depression brought on by lack of sleep. I was working nights. I was a new nurse. I was a mom. I had lots of pressures. It was after my first divorce. Mm-hmm. And I recognized I'd lost like 20 pounds. I weighed 97 pounds. I was, you know, my friends could see that I was in a really bad place. And I didn't realize that I was having suicidal ideation until it stopped, right? And then I was like, oh, I was thinking about not being here, right? So that was kind of one of those where I pulled out of it pretty fast. I had a lot of support. I had a good therapist. I had my family, you know, I had friends that were supportive. And that's much more common for people, right? It's like you have a little bout, and but you've got good support. What happened to me in 2020 was all that support was gone. Mm. So here I am mostly crying out to the system. To, you know, I went to a psychiatrist, I went to a psychologist, I went to therapy. My therapist was good, but it was, this was too much for her to handle. It was too much trauma. Like I really...
You think it would trigger her own trauma?
Yeah. I think that's why a lot of decent therapists who are decent with pretty simple stuff are horrible with significant trauma, because it like triggers their trauma very much. I think that's 100% what happened to my therapist. I worked with her for 5 months. I trusted her. She knew all my secrets. I felt like she was really helping me. I saw her intensively twice a week. I saw another therapist once a week for intensive trauma treatment. That was really helping me. And so when I lost my main therapist, I lost that the second therapist as well. I lost the trauma therapist as well because they worked in the same clinic.
I think so. That's a really good point.
Therapists, they can handle it up to a certain point. But when you're super, when someone is very, very traumatized, whether it's, you know, long-term psychological abuse or sexual abuse or, you know, religious trauma, oh my gosh, another whole show, right? Mm-hmm. So much shame around religion. But there are so many therapists that do well with the, you know, the simple, oh, I'm a little depressed, or I'm a little whatever. Things. Yeah, and especially with people who have decent support, right? Like if you have a decent family and you're just going for, like, you know, to talk about your troubles, that's great. But if you don't have a robust family support system or friend support system, which I lost all of that between 2020 and 2022. By 2022, my mom was still alive, but just barely. And I had lost all my support systems. I'd lost my job. I'd moved cross country. Yeah. So it's, yeah, what you said. We trigger the fear and the shame in therapists who have not worked through their own trauma enough.
Mm-hmm. And I think that probably applies to any other people who belong to the institutions. Mm-hmm. That's because we're saying here, these institutions are run by human beings.
Yeah.
And those human beings are fallible and vulnerable to all the same things that the folks who are seeking assistance or the people who, you know, you're their patients, their clients, yep, et cetera. Human beings are all susceptible to the same things. So there's going to be occasions, unfortunately, where I guess, you know, the people you're supposed to trust are unprepared or and just don't know how to respond correctly. And that's, yeah. I would hate to kind of like leave off the conversation on this note, because I think I want to revisit the conversation at another time to really talk about, okay, so what do we do?
What do we
what's
do?
What's a better
way?
Because
there are solutions. There really are. So
I want to call out problems without solutions, like where possible. Yeah. But I think, you know, this is just where, you know, these past conversations have been airing out. Yeah. The goal of this is to air out all the things that are going wrong, why they go wrong.
Yep.
How can we do it better? I think that would be another great conversation.
I agree. And I have colleagues who are sort of experts in suicidality, and I'd love to bring one of them in and have a three-way conversation about.
I think that would be great. Yeah. And I, you know, I would hope to say, like, we even just us here talking on the air about this can help me just cast a ray of light on
normalize. It's just, this is, you're not alone. You really are not alone. There are lots and lots of people out there that are
feeling the same thing. Know, the stigma is just, I think it is the adhesive that binds any kind of what we call disease of despair in place. It creates that shame, that fear. Not only do you have, you know, not only are people dealing with their pain from their, you know, whether it's the trauma or that they've experienced or something they're going through in their current lives, stress, there's the original problem, but then you create this extra layer of toxic gunk. Sticky gunk that makes it all worse, and that's stigma.
Yeah.
It just creates this whole other layer. I think I could spend a lot of time more talking about this myself with, you know, I've heard a lot of people in the military.
Yep. First responders. Yeah. I mean, it's just, you know, suicide in people in the helping professions is sky high because it's like.
Well, even people being able to actively talk about having mental health in certain career fields.
You can't. You lose your job. I mean, that's what happened to me. Once I started talking openly about this stuff, I lost my job. Lost my career. Yeah.
It's a travesty. It's almost seems like we're at a really critical point where it's almost, you would just want to ask, do we just scrap the whole system and start from scratch or what? Because all these institutions are just failing and failing.
It's a crossroads. I think we're at a crossroads where people like you and me who are trying to get the word out, there's so many people out there begging for this information. They just don't know where to find it. So I'm so grateful for this show because I know it's a little community radio, but if this conversation can catch fire and you know, we can take it across the country, that would make a huge difference to so many people.
Every one more person who is more informed, that's already, it's you know, worth everything. Because
absolutely.
Every person who gains the knowledge they need to make better decisions for themselves, to look out for themselves, for each other, to kind of break free, to become aware of these problems, is less vulnerable to the problems, and that's already empowering. And I would hope that this is, you know, in maybe a small way, maybe big way, I don't know, but at least in a very small way, helpful to folks listening. So I want to just leave off here with, you know, just thanking you again, Tara, for joining me. I know I keep calling you Tara. It is driving me nuts. Thank you really for being so candid in your conversation.
This is my fight. I'm on this path and it's where I need to be.
And I think you're doing a marvelous job. And I want to thank you for bringing your story to us here on the air. And to all of you listening today, I really appreciate your time. I know this was definitely it's kind of a heavier one, or it's at least it's a harder to digest kind of topic. But I hope that for those of you listening, you know, if this felt personal to you, I hope that it can be an empowering conversation for you to hear, and I hope it's validating, if nothing else, because that validation is so important. It's so, we're all human, we all go through these things, and I think all these ideas we make up where we stigmatize each other do nothing but make things worse. And it's not, you don't have to play the game. The good news is
you don't have to do what people tell you.
Like, we will, I think, revisit it another time and maybe focus a little bit more on the what do we do.
I love that solution. So I'll think about that and really, I think that's a great idea to focus on what can we do rather than get just stuck in the despair. Yeah.
Well, because it's easy to call out the problems. It's harder to call in the solutions, but that's where the real power comes from.
Next time I'll bring some resources.
Perfect. Yeah, and that's where the real power comes from as well. So, again, thank you guys for joining us today and spending this last hour with us. Tara, thank you for joining me here and, really getting deep with me and having this very important conversation today. Listeners, you will be able to listen to this on, if you re-listen to this episode after it airs, you are welcome to do so by either going to the archives. This will only work for a few weeks, just FYI. And I know that KYRS webpage is not the most intuitive, but if you look up KYRS archive, go to that page, go on the button that lets you select different shows, scroll down, hit So Did You Hear. You can hear up to, I think, 6 weeks back of shows that have aired recently if you're hearing this within 6 weeks of November 21st, 2025. Otherwise, this show will be posted to my show page, and that is much easier to find. You just go to Google, put in "So Did You Hear KYRS," my show page should come up, and you will find the playlist of this show, the previous show that is connected to our conversation, as well as other recordings. So thank you all for tuning in and for listening, and we will catch you next time. Bye-bye.